From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
When Winnie Mandela moved in South Africa, I knew Mandela was going to be free. When Rosa Parks moved in Alabama, I knew we were getting off the back of the bus. And I want you to know, because I know you're going to move today, that we're going to see the bombs ended in Vietnam, and we are no longer going to tolerate being strip searched.
Jackie Jackson with Union leader Dennis Rivera and Robert Kennedy Jr. upon their release from jail in Puerto Rico. And as Israel insists it'll continue assassinating Palestinians, we'll talk with Professor Edward Said. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Senior South African figures slammed the United States yesterday for threatening to boycott a UN conference on racism and condemned the, quote, evasive language of draft declarations. National Assembly Speaker Frene Ginwala, attending a preparatory conference in Cape Town, said she found it unacceptable that the United States, which guaranteed freedom of speech in its constitution, wanted to exclude Zionism and reparations for slavery from the agenda of the conference. The South African non-governmental coalition earlier accused the United States of arrogance bordering on self-interest for threatening to boycott the conference. Its director said it's ironic that the nation that claims to be the defender of the free world consistently uses its considerable economic and military might to pursue its own narrow interests. The top U.S. official working on an international treaty to reduce cigarette smoking worldwide has resigned at a time when the United States is embroiled in contentious negotiations with more than 150 countries on how to counter the rising global use of tobacco. Bush administration officials said yesterday that the negotiator, Thomas Novotny, has stepped down for personal reasons, but three people who've spoken with him in recent weeks said he had privately expressed distress over the administration's decision to soften the U.S. positions on key issues, including restrictions on secondhand smoke and the advertising and marketing of cigarettes. Colombian government troops pursued a battered guerrilla column through the mountains yesterday after reportedly killing about 60 rebels in one of the military's biggest battlefield victories in years. U.S.-made Black Hawk helicopters were central in the attack. In addition, the chief of Colombia's military said technical intelligence allowed the military to track the rebel column before the battle erupted. He did not say where the technical intelligence was coming from, but the United States can gain such information from its spy planes and satellite imagery. The U.S. Embassy said it had no immediate comment on whether the U.S. was providing this information. The Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal yesterday handed down its first conviction for genocide, finding a Bosnian Serb general guilty for the deaths of up to 8,000 Muslims at the UN-protected enclave of Srebrenica. The verdict and 46-year sentence for General Radoslav Krstic could be a harbinger of more genocide trials of those at the top of the command chain in the Balkan Wars. Italy's interior minister yesterday ordered the transfer of three top police officials following a probe into the conduct of security forces at last month's Group of Eight summit in Genoa. He did not explain the transfer, but the probe has focused on the legitimacy of a bloody police raid on a school serving as a media center and sleeping quarters for anti-globalization groups, and on allegations that arrested activists were beaten at a police station. Meanwhile, international journalist bodies and media watchdogs have expressed grave concern over Italian prosecutors' efforts to seize journalists' photographs and video footage of protests at the G8 summit. Over the past week, Genoa state prosecutors have issued a series of orders to media organizations to hand over photos and TV cassettes of the demonstration in the city during the July 20th to 22nd summit of world leaders. A spokesperson for Reporters Without Borders said, "We're completely against the idea that journalists should be used in one way or another as a substitute to make up for the fact that the police or magistrates were not there. That is not our job." He said, "If people realize that the work of photographers and cameramen will end up in the hands of police, then they will no longer be able to carry out their work. Obviously, it puts the journalists in danger." The FBI has opened civil rights investigations in seven cases in which Prince George's County police shot or allegedly beat people, bringing to more than 30 the number of federal probes involving county officers in the past 2 years. An FBI spokesman said said yesterday that four of the investigations will seek to determine whether police violated the civil rights of four men shot in separate incidents dating to 1997. All of the men were unarmed and shot in the back. Two of them died. The seven cases were detailed last month in a series of articles in the Washington Post, which found that Prince George's police shot and killed more people per officer than any other large police force in the nation from 1990 through 2000. Since 1990, Prince George's officers have shot 122 people, 47 of them fatally. Top police officials have concluded that each of the shootings was justified.
I'll tell you the story of John Henry Falk. I'll tell you of his trials and the trouble trail he walked. And I'll tell you of the tyrants, the ones you never see. Murder is the role they play and hatred is their fee. On the TV and the radio, John Henry Falk was known. He talked to many thousands with a mind that was his own. But he could not close his eyes when the list were passed around, so he tried to move the union to tear the blacklist down. His friends, they tried to warn him he was heading for a fall. If he spoke against the blacklist, he had no chance at all. But he laughed away their warnings and he laughed away their fears, for how could lies destroy the work of many honest years? Then slowly, oh so slowly, his life began to change. People would avoid his eyes, his friends were acting strange. And he finally saw the power of the hidden poison pen. When they told him that his job was through, he'd never work again. And he could not believe what his sad eyes had found. He stared in disbelief as his world come tumbling down. And as the noose grew tighter, at last the trap was clear. For every place he turned to go, that list would soon be there, oh, that list. And is there any bottom to the fears that grow inside? Is there any bottom to the hate that you must hide? And is there any end to your long road of despair? Is there any end to the pain that you must bear? His wife and children trembled, the time was running short, when a man of law got on their side and took them into court. And there upon the stand they could not hide behind their lies, and the cancer of the fascist was displayed before our eyes. Hey, you blacklist, you've seen what you have done. I've seen the men you've ruined and the lives you tried to run. But the one thing that I've found is the only ones you spare are those that do not have a brain or those that do not care. And you men who point your fingers and spread your lies around, you men that left your souls behind to drag us to the ground, you can put my name right down there or will not try to hide. For if there's one man on the blacklist, I'll be right there by his side. For I'd rather go hungry and beg upon the street than earn my bread on dead men's souls and crawl beneath your feet. And I will not play your haters' game and hate you in return, for it's only through the love of man the blacklist can be burned. For it's only through the love of man the blacklist can be burned.
The Ballad of John Henry Falk here on Democracy Now! 50 years ago, his groundbreaking radio program, The John Henry Falk Show on CBS Radio, began in 1951. The program, which featured music, political humor, and listener participation, ran for 6 years. In 1957, Falk saw his radio career destroyed by an anti-communist witch hunt when refused to honor the infamous blacklist that targeted liberal radio, TV, and movie personalities of the 1950s. His story was immortalized by the folk singer Phil Oakes. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. In international news, Palestinian President Yasser Arafat met with Pope John Paul in Rome yesterday. He called for a halt to all violence in the Middle East and the immediate introduction of international observers into the West Bank and Gaza Strip. But as Arafat met with the Pope, Israeli soldiers and killed two Palestinians and wounded seven others, including a 12- and a 16-year-old boy. Israel continues to defy calls for it to admit international observers and to defy international condemnation of its recent assassination of 14 Palestinians. Israeli officials insist they'll continue with the extrajudicial execution of Palestinian activists. More than 500 Palestinians have been killed since the start of the Second Intifada last fall. We're joined on the phone right now by Edward Sayhi, professor of comparative literature at Columbia University, internationally renowned literary and cultural critic, and one of the world's leading spokespeople for Palestinian self-determination. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, first, your reaction to the situation on the ground.
Well, it's heartrending because basically the Israelis are killing Palestinians at random, pretty much as they wish. I think, you know, the way the news is reported, you get the impression that there are really two sides, or at least two states. There aren't. There's one state, Israel, which is, you know, one of the most heavily armed, most modern militaries in the world with a nuclear force, picking off basically an unarmed people without a state, without an army, without artillery, without air defenses, without anything. Israel using every means at its disposal basically to massacre, as they did the other day, people in the name of preventing terrorism. I mean, for example, the killing of 8 Palestinians in Nablus the other day, of which really only 2 could even vaguely qualify as resistance fighters. The rest, there were two children killed, just went as collateral damage. And the lives of our people are simply being used as cannon fodder for the Israelis. All in the interest of this mad security that they have, escalating all the time, obviously drawing to the point where they can take over what the 18 or so percent land of the West Bank that they gave up during the Oslo peace process. I mean, it's a horrible situation where the U.S. is the only country in the world backing Israel to the hilt, with a few demurrals here and there from Mr. Powell.
The U.S. was forced to condemn the latest Israeli assassinations, but it's never suggested that Israelis be punished for these killings and refuses to pressure Israel to accept international monitors.
Right. Either that or to withhold arms, because even as we speak, there is a constant flow of arms. I mean, a month ago, Israel was supplied with another 50 F-16s by the United States, and the supply of Apache and Cobra helicopters continues, and there's an unending stream of missile and other artillery going to the Israeli army so that they can continue this. In the meantime, by the way, they've also indicated that they're going to mobilize their reserves, and offices have been opened in major Western capitals, 2 of them at least in this country, so that reservists can sign up. I mean, they're really planning, I think, an all-out war and invasion, and the area is full of rumors, at least, of war and impending invasion. I mean, this is very similar to the summer of 82.
What kind of support do Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority have right now, especially compared to groups like Hamas?
I think very little. You know, that's another tragedy in the whole thing. We are very misled and misguided in the sense of having leaders and guides that have failed utterly. Arafat, I would say, is totally isolated with his tiny group of his tiny coterie of experts and negotiators who make declarations and go to places like the Vatican and elsewhere, basically leaving their people to their own, a terrible fate. There are no services to speak of. Hamas, whatever you think of it, and I've always been, you know, in total disagreement with their methods and their ideas, but at any rate, it supplies people with food, with help during crises of this sort, you know, medical help. They make a stab at education, something that the authority has no power to give and no willingness to do, because I think this is very important to understand, that whatever else Arafat has done in the past, and it's been considerable in support of his people and his cause, he is now trying to keep himself alive, and the best way he can do that is to appear at places like the Vatican and London and so on, and not by the side of his people. And the same goes for his lieutenants, who are doing the same thing. It's a tragedy of awful proportion, with the Palestinians completely isolated, the Arab countries making declarations about how terrible it is, and we condemn, and we don't want to norm, and all that. But none of them has paid anything, even in the way of emergency funds, to help the Palestinians. And we are really an orphaned and abandoned people. It's our perhaps most awful hour.
Professor Saeed, the U.S. says it'll boycott the upcoming U.N. World Conference Against Racism unless virtually all language critical of Israel is stricken from the agenda. Originally, U.S. officials said they just wanted references of Zionism as racism dropped, but now they're saying that's not enough. The rest of the language charges Israel is setting up a new form of apartheid with its settlement policy and discrimination against Palestinians. Your comment?
Well, look, Israel is, in fact, practicing apartheid. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. You know, when you have a state that is made up of a majority of Jews, for the time being, I should add, and non-Jews are not allowed to buy land, are not allowed to own land, are not allowed to sell or lease land. If only Jews are allowed to return, whereas, you know, 4.5 million Palestinians who were driven out, their forefathers were driven out in 1948, can't return. Only Jews can. I mean, I could go on and on and on. But, you know, what in fact is, you have apartheid, you have a settlement policy on the West Bank and Gaza practiced by Israel that is completely discriminatory. It only allows Jews to settle and be protected and dominate the majority, as is the case, for example, in the city of Hebron, where roughly 300 settlers in the middle of the city have paralyzed and brought a curfew of now lasting almost 3 months to 120,000 people. I mean, this is apartheid. And if the United States is going to boycott the conference as a way of, you know, protecting Israel, you know, it shows that this country's foreign policy, at least in the Middle East, is totally dominated by a tiny lobby, the Zionist lobby, which can make it do its own will, you know, thumbing its nose at the rest of the world, which is, of course, in keeping with Bush foreign policy in general. But this is particularly scandalous since it's going to be held, this conference, in Durban, at a time when, you know, South Africa is celebrating, you know, roughly 7 years or 8 years of post-apartheid liberation. And here's the United States, in effect, taking the world back to the apartheid days of the 70s and the 80s. My feeling is that, in the end, the U.S. will not boycott. I mean, they will exert maximum pressure to try to, as you say, get rid of some of the criticism of Israel. But I don't think it's going to be possible to move an entire world. And I think they feel, you know, there is an African-American vote in this country which is deeply interested in being in Durban, many other groups as well, liberal and non-liberal human rights groups and so on and so forth. So I think in the end they will go, but they're making as much noise now as possible to prevent criticism of Israel, all of which increases, I think, the likelihood that there will be criticism of Israel. But my hunch is that the U.S. will turn up, nonetheless.
We only have a minute, but yeah. Professor Saeed, what do you feel now the Palestinians should do?
Well, you know, it's very easy for me to speak sitting in New York, many miles away, but my feeling is that we really have no recourse whatever but to do basically two things. One is to increase the level of mass participation and resistance. I think isolated acts of I don't know what to call it, of crazy sacrifice, which is what Hamas has been encouraging, really bring more damage on Palestinians than they do profit. And I think that if more organizations went out in mass and to confront Israeli tanks and try to prevent and ally themselves with, this is the second point, to ally themselves with a small group but increasing number of Israelis and Israeli associations trying to prevent house demolitions, the destruction of property and orchards and uprooting olive trees and all that. That is our only hope because, and I suppose a part of that is to mount an international campaign on behalf of the Palestinian human rights, not on behalf of returning to this, you know, terrible, horribly destructive peace process which has brought us to this present pass because Palestinians, the leadership has given up on the basic principles, which are land and exchange of land for peace, very clear, and a whole set of internationally recognized human rights. In Oslo, they threw themselves at the Americans and the Israelis, and look what's happened. I mean, it's a leadership without a basis in the population. It's a population that's been isolated and is being picked off by the Israelis. You know, like so many. Hamsters, we're isolated in the Arab world.
Edward Saeed, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Professor Saeed teaches comparative literature at Columbia University, internationally renowned literary and cultural critic, one of the world's leading spokespeople for Palestinian self-determination. His recent memoirs is called Out of Place. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In a minute, we go to Dennis Rivera, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and Jackie Jackson, who just been released from jail protesting the bombing of Vieques. But now we turn to the African-American author and editor Wilbert Rideau, his case. He was reindicted several days ago on murder charges, shackled hand and foot and wearing a bulletproof vest. Rideau was taken from the state penitentiary at Angola, Louisiana, and returned to Lake Charles, where he faces his fourth trial in the 1961 murder of a bank teller. His murder conviction was overturned by the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in December because African Americans were improperly excluded from the grand jury. But the local district attorney vowed to try Rideau again rather than let him go free. The award-winning prison journalist has already spent 39 years in prison after initially being turned down for a position on the prison publication The Angolite, which had an all-white staff. Rideau started a publication of his own called The Lifer and wrote a column for black newspapers. In 1976, he was named editor of The Angolite and used the magazine to examine such topics as prisoner suicide, rape, riots, executions, and prisoner rights. Under his leadership, the magazine was showered with honors, including the George Polk Award for Special Interest Reporting and the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award. We turn now to one of his attorneys, George Kendall. Can you explain what happened, how this reindictment?
Yes, the case has returned to Calcasieu Parish. As you said, the district attorney there, Rick Bryan, has vowed to reconvict Mr. Rideau of murder to guarantee that he will return to Angola with a life sentence, and in Mr. Bryant's view, I think hopefully remain there until he dies. And so that's what the district attorney wants. I think there are a good number of citizens in Calcasieu Parish, however, who I think either don't want any retrial whatsoever. A TV station there has been polling, and over 70% of the parish has voted that they think a fourth trial in this case would be a waste of money. And so I have some hope that, I'm not sure when, that we're going to be able to resolve this matter in the way it ought to be, that Mr. Rideau has served, he's paid his debt to society, and it's now time for everyone to move on.
Can you explain his crime and his original sentence and how it came to be that it was overturned?
His crime was a robbery of a bank. There were three bank employees involved, and one of them unfortunately died during this event. He was arrested shortly thereafter the crime and interrogated by the local sheriff. Unbeknownst to him, at the time of his interrogation, the sheriff had allowed the local TV to bring a camera into the interrogation room. And thereafter, on several occasions, his statement to the authorities, which implicated himself deeply in this crime, was played on television over and over again. He was convicted by an all-white, all-male jury and death sentenced in April of 1961. In June of 1963, the United States Supreme Court reversed his conviction. And this is the only time in my memory the court has used this kind of language. They characterized his 1961 trial as a kangaroo court proceeding. It was obvious to the Supreme Court that once his statement
had been televised repeatedly, that the case ought to have been moved to another part of Louisiana where potential jurors had not seen that statement. He was retried in 1964 in East Baton Rouge Parish, again before an all-white, all-male jury. And I think the jury spent about 15 minutes before they imposed the death sentence. That death sentence and conviction was overturned in 1969 by a federal court because numerous persons who just harbored some doubts about the death penalty were excluded from the jury. He was again tried in 1970, again in East Baton Rouge Parish, again before an all-white, all-male jury. That jury took 8 minutes before deciding that a death sentence should be imposed. And finally, in 1973, the Louisiana Supreme Court vacated his death sentence, as it had to under the United States Supreme Court decision in Furman versus Georgia, and imposed a life sentence.
And then, how did it get overturned, ultimately?
And then thereafter, Mr. Addo sought, because of good behavior, sought release on by clemency. And although in the time that he's been incarcerated, over 700 other Louisiana prisoners who've been convicted of murder were released, he was not. Four times the Board of Pardon and Parole recommended his release. Four times governors of Louisiana said no. And so in 1994, he brought a claim to the federal court that blacks had been excluded very significantly from the grand jury process. He had raised this issue both before his second and third trials, but the state courts rejected it out of hand. And in December of last year, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals unanimously concluded that he was entitled to a new trial because there was very serious, egregious racial discrimination in the makeup of the grand jury. And thus, that's why the case is returned to Calcasieu Parish now.
Why is the district attorney so determined not to let Wilburito go?
Well, that's a very good question. He has been the point person for the district attorney's office for the last 15 or 16 years. He personally has gone to the Board of Pardon and Parole and urged that Mr. Addo not be set free. He characterizes this crime as really the crime of the century, and which is unfortunate because there have been a number of very aggravated murders in Calcasieu Parish since this crime involving white offenders, and all those white offenders have been, or most of those white offenders have been released from prison, unlike Mr. Addo. But I think he is also running for re-election next year. 75% of the voting public is white, and so I think we're seeing some influence of that election on what Mr. Bryant is saying to the press about this case.
George Kendall, what about your representation of Wilburito?
Well, the Legal Defense Fund sees this case as an important case. Mr. Addo has spent 40 years in prison. He has done everything one can do to redeem himself. If he were simply treated like other prisoners in Louisiana, he would have been released a long time ago. They've made an exception for him by requiring him to stay in prison this long. I think there are only four or five other prisoners in the history of Louisiana who've served more time than he has. In a sense, his achievements now are working against him. And Mr. Addo's view for many years has simply been, don't treat me any better than anyone else, just treat me the same. That if you're going to parole people who've been convicted of murder after 15 or 20 years, then I don't want any less, I don't want any more. And unfortunately, I think politics have intervened in the clemency process and have kept him in prison. And so we also see this as an important case of why it's oftentimes unwise to impose such long sentences on youthful offenders. Mr. Addo was an eighth grade dropout, 19 years old, when this crime occurred. I think no one could have imagined that he would, under the circumstances he was in, achieve what he has achieved. But it simply shows that under the most difficult of circumstances, redemption is oftentimes possible.
Has the court refused to appoint you?
I'm sorry?
Has the court refused to appoint you?
Yes, the court did refuse to. Last week we had a hearing which we had no notice of. I just happened to be in Calcasieu Parish, and Mr. Rideau is indigent. Everyone agrees to that. He's entitled to appointed compensated counsel. And the trial judge, they refused to appoint myself and Julian Murray, a lawyer, a very good lawyer in New Orleans, who's represented Mr. Rideau for more than 15 years at no charge to Mr. Rideau, who's a very talented lawyer. And in most other courts, it would have been a no-brainer that Mr. Murray and myself would have been appointed. Instead, the trial judge appointed another attorney from New Orleans who no one really knows, and the local public defender, Ronald Ware, who's a very good lawyer, but whose office is hopelessly overwhelmed with a huge volume of cases.
Can they do that? I mean, if you have both represented him for so long?
Well, we think, and we are in the process of filing papers to the court, that the court made a huge mistake, and that we are confident that the court is going to see, once he sees the legal authority, he's going to reach a different conclusion.
What about the issue of how he was brought out and what clothes?
Well, that was particularly disturbing to me because it's important that when people are charged with crime that they, if they choose to appear in court, appear in civilian clothing. But the state has no right to tell somebody who's charged with crime what they are going to wear in court. And we had provided Mr. Rideau with civilian clothing. That's what he preferred to wear. And in fact, we brought the clothing in before the hearing. The marshals had no problem with letting him wear that clothing. And to my utter amazement, after he had put all that clothing on, the judge directed the marshals to require Mr. Rideau to take that clothing off and put on his orange jail jumpsuit to be manacled and to put a flak jacket on. And that's how he was forced to appear in court, and we immediately objected to that. There was no security reason to do that. Nothing required that. And we're also going to be filing papers with the court in the next couple of weeks to say that that was also a mistake, and that the state simply can't require citizens to don its clothing to come to court.
Finally, George Kendall, are there any right-wing groups that are influencing this case?
Unfortunately, yes. There are a number of organizations in Louisiana who tout themselves as friends of victims, who I think are playing a significant role in putting media attention on how unfair Mr. Rideau's release would be to the victims of this case. And they are well organized and well funded. In fact, in Louisiana now, the Board of Pardons now is made up of five members. One of those members, by law, has to be somebody connected with one of these groups. And just recently, this board changed its policy so that the only way somebody can be voted for a pardon or for clemency is if the Board of Pardon unanimously makes the recommendation. And so now that one member really now controls pardon and commutation policy in Louisiana. I'm not aware of any other state that has such an arrangement. And clemencies and paroles have dropped to almost nothing in Louisiana as a result.
George Kendall, I want to thank you for being with us, the lawyer for Wilbur Rideau.
They say every man needs protection. They say every man must fall. Yet I swear I see my reflection someplace so high.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we talk about being people being released, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Union leader Dennis Rivera were released from jail this week. They were protesting the Navy bombing of Vieques. Navy security personnel fired rubber bullets and tear gas at protesters and journalists on Vieques yesterday as the Navy resumed its bombing of the island. More than 23,000 Marines, sailors, and soldiers engaged in the largest military maneuvers on the island since a civilian was killed by Navy bombing 2 years ago. At least 12 protesters invaded the Navy range in an attempt to stop the latest round of bombing and shelling. Well, it was electric at 1199, the Union headquarters in New York yesterday, as environmental lawyer Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and the union leader Dennis Rivera arrived after serving 30 days in federal prison for trespassing on Vieques during a previous round of bombing. Kennedy was in jail during the birth of his son. We now go to the event yesterday. Among those who spoke was Ozzie Davis.
It was about 47 years ago, the Supreme Court passed its famous decision outlawing segregation. South was in turmoil. What to do about schools? The farmers in Mississippi and Georgia had to plant their crops, but they were denied capital at the banks if they signed a petition to send their kids to school. And who was among the first to step into the breach, raise money to send to those farmers in Mississippi? 1199. So it's no surprise. It's no surprise that when the call goes out for help from Vieques, that 1199 becomes the focal point of resistance and offering its hand to help, and even its president to sit in jail to make the point. That is true 1199, and that is one of the reasons why I'm so happy to remain affiliated with this great, great union. Now, I don't know what we're doing up in Bronxville, but, you know, the next action, I'm sure I'll be there. Now, I have had the benefit all my life of the presence of a strong, loving, caring woman, my mother, who is still alive at 103 today. Right? I've had the benefit of being married 52 years to Ruby Dee, who is a strong woman. I know a good, strong, beautiful woman when I see one. And I say to you, none is more beautiful, none more strong, none more dedicated to the cause to the point where she puts her life, her dignity on the line than the one who it is my pleasure to present to you now, Jackie.
$11.99 in the house. Oh, let me thank you for the years and years of support that you have given to our cause, to my husband, to my family, and to all the wonderful things we believe in. Give yourselves a round of applause. I'm here for several reasons. First, I'm here to welcome home the prisoners of war, Dennis Rivera and Mr. Kennedy. I want to say to you, you can't help somebody without helping yourself. When I went to Vieques, I was proud enough and arrogant enough to think I was going over there to help somebody else. This was one of the richest experiences I have ever had, and one of the life-altering situations that I have ever been in. I discovered in Vieques that I was a little confused, because when I went to court, I was sitting in a federal, under the federal government that I pay taxes to. And they said, for those of you who cannot understand the proceedings, we want you to have put on these translating headphones and machinery. So I said, give me one, because I don't speak Spanish. They said, no, it's not for you. It's for the Spanish-speaking community. Here we are in another place with a different language, governing a people with our tax dollars, and we are arrogant enough to do it in English so they don't understand it. I think that's when I made my greatest move. I ask that, since you've insulted me and the people here, give me, release me based on my own recognizance. The jail bail is excessive. The people there can't pay the bail. I fought from the inside because I stopped eating. It was a devastating experience to find them intimidating women the way they do. I have another issue. I said you can't help somebody without helping yourself. It wasn't until I caught the plane that a Caucasian woman came to me and said, Mrs. Jackson, I'm so glad you didn't submit or capitulate to the strip search. She said, because women are made to bow and toss all over this country. Well, today, because I entered the prison system and my number is 221-13-069 and I am on probation as I speak, I plan to not only see to the deliverance of the will of the people of Vieques, but also that women are never subjected to this kind of humiliation as strip searches. I need your help. I want you to celebrate. I want you to celebrate the release of Dennis and Mr. Kennedy. But I want you to know you are 1 second, one number, one incorrect number in the system for being a number yourself. So don't just see us standing here on this stage as if we are just special, different. We are a part of you. And based on the fact that now that we can be handcuffed because of a seatbelt, and I was told in Puerto Rico that Robert versus Rhode Island did not even matter. That is the Supreme Court decision that says you are not, it is not necessary to strip search you anymore unless you are suspected of carrying contraband. And I raise the question in jail, what makes you think I'm carrying contraband? Do not let these people take the dignity that we've worked so hard for to create around civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is as old as was before Jesus Christ. And if you take a journey into your religious history, you know Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know Daniel in the lion's den. You know Paul and Silas. You know Esther. I want you to know, get ready, get ready, get ready. Get ready, get ready, get ready. Because when women move, the whole earth shakes. When Winnie Mandela moved in South Africa, I knew Mandela was going to be free. When Rosa Parks moved in Alabama, I knew we were getting off the back of the bus. And I want you to know, because I know you're going to move today, that we're going to see the bombs ended in Vieques, and we are no longer going to tolerate being strip searched. Thank you very much.
And that was Jesse Jackson's partner, Jackie Jackson, speaking yesterday at 11 1999, the SCI local. As the bombing continues in Vieques, we're going to skip the next break, alerting stations, as we are sometimes want to do when we have critical information, as we bring you the words of Dennis Rivera and Robert Kennedy and others who spoke yesterday, as Dennis Rivera and Robert F. Kennedy had just come out of prison in Puerto Rico. This is SEIU 1199 local president Dennis Rivera.
I'd like to thank, and I feel very humbled to have here in the presence of Martin Luther King Jr., who's be here with us. Jackie Jackson, who basically took over the jail. She is legendary over there. She is a legend over there. They got her out of there. No, true story. You know, when she refused to submit herself to the searches, which some of us, we didn't have the courage that she had, because they send you to the hold, you know, and that's incommunicated by 23 hours. And we said, well, I don't know. So this is not that painful, you know. So then she was at that point not even in trial. So at that moment, they basically found a judge, and they brought her because she was meeting with all the women, and she was carrying all the... So she is a legend over there. The guards, you could hear the guards talk about her. I'd like to talk a little bit about Vieques, too. I think we all know what the problem is. But I want to update you. Last Sunday, there was a referendum held, where 70% of the people voted to stop the bombing in the island of Vieques. You know, they're going to start bombing today, and they're going to conduct the most massive maneuvers that they have ever done in recent time. So it's like if they want to basically send a message of who really is the bully in here. So I will say that the following. That I made the following pledges that on behalf of all of us here, that not only we were going to redouble our work and our effort, and that we were going to basically help and raise more money to help and assist from many of our friends and our colleagues and our allies to help and assist them in terms of fighting this fight of civil disobedience, to try to fight in the United States to make sure that that President Bush stops the bombing in the island of Vieques. I made the pledge on behalf of all of you that you communicated through the letters that you sent me that we want to increase our participation and make sure that we are able to get the Navy out of Vieques.
Local 1199 President Dennis Rivera speaking yesterday at Union headquarters in New York, as well Robert F. Kennedy Jr., environmental lawyer.
I want to thank all of you for this wonderful greeting. When we get off the airplane this morning, we had no idea. I thought I was going to a press conference right now. And it's so great to see so many of my 1199 family who've been here time and time again for me and for my issues to give us this kind of greeting. I have to say this. We just spent 30 days in jail down there. And for me, I'll confess something to you. I feel like we're perpetuating a hoax here because... For me, there were a lot of people who were suffering in that jail with us because they had, in order to satisfy their consciences, many of them had lost jobs, many of them were having difficulty supporting their families. I did not feel like I was one of them. I felt like, for me, I was on a 30-day Caribbean vacation, and the only hero in my family is my wife, who took care of my 5 kids and gave me a 6th one while I was going. So, I'm also really lucky to know this guy, your president, Dennis Rivera. Dennis was the one who got me into this mess. But I owed him a favor, and he said it wouldn't take long. He got me involved in Vieques. He said, would you come down here and look at some of these environmental issues? I found an island down there that is really a tropical jewel. It is the same size as St. Croix or St. Thomas, but it has more physical beauty than any of the Virgin Islands that earn $250 million a year in tourism revenue. And there's no tourists that go to Vieques because the Navy has made sure that there's no industry on that island and that there's no ability to support a livelihood for the people who live on that island. But it has these extraordinary tropical hardwood forests. It has 10 of the 20 finest white sand beaches in the Caribbean, these extraordinary, some of the most abundant reefs in the world. It has pelican rookeries that are for endangered species. There's 13 endangered species that live in the live fire zone. And all of these things were being destroyed by the naval bombardment. The hardwood forests were being pulverized. The groundwater had been contaminated with deadly chemicals. The pelican rookeries were burned with incendiary bombs. The whales were bombed. The turtles who nest there on the beaches were bombed. But the worst injury, and the most shocking injury to me, was to the people of the island. What I found was a series of reports, and the Navy now has criticized these reports and say, well, they're not refereed, they weren't published in refereed journals, but I deal in these issues all the time in these currencies, and I can tell you, these reports use the highest scientific standards that are available, and they are good science. And what they say is that this island, the 9,300 residents who live there, have the highest infant mortality rate in the Caribbean. They have the highest overall mortality rate in Puerto Rico. They have the highest cancer rate in Puerto Rico. They have, of any municipality, that many of the people on the island are suffering from an enlarging of the liner of the heart, a disease called vibroacoustic disease. And recent federal studies have shown that, and then also, that the people of the island have in their blood systems deadly levels or very high levels of antimony, arsenic, lead, zinc, cyanide, and uranium. And that these chemicals also occur in all of the fishes that surround the island, the crabs, the seaweed, the grasses, and a recent report that shows that the food crops in the residential areas also have all of these diseases, all of these chemicals which cause deadly diseases. The worst injury, though, that I saw was the injury that I saw to democracy on Vieques. And this is what got me to do the civil disobedience.
Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., talking about the legal case that he took to court.
The black letter Supreme Court case law says that if you fail to do the biological assessment, the federal court must enjoin any disturbance of that area until the biological assessment is completed. And so this, to me, seems like a very clear case that we should win against the Navy. I brought it to court confident that we were going to win. And instead of listening to our case or giving us a hearing in court, the judge sat on that case for 8 months and did not allow us into the courtroom through two and then three and now four different sets of naval bombing. Well, I had been to the island of Vieques, and I have clients there, hundreds of clients, 28 different groups representing most of the fishermen and other people on the island. And what I found was that these were people who are American citizens, and yet many of them did not feel that they had the benefits of the judicial system or of being citizens of this country. The people of Vieques don't have a congressman, as nobody from Puerto Rico does. Now, you may have heard recently that in Texas, the government was considering bombing South Padre Island, or switching their bombing sites from Vieques. And a few people on South Padre Island said, we don't want that, and they called their congressman, and their congressman called the military, and he said, if you do this, we're going to have you up for a hearing on Capitol Hill. And 5 days later, the Navy said, we don't want to go to South Padre Island. And that's what's happened all across the country. There are hundreds and hundreds of places that are preferable to Vieques to bomb, but all of them have a congressman. And in Vieques, they don't have a congressman. And the people who live in Vieques are people of color, generally speaking, more than the rest of Puerto Ricans. They're the descendants of free blacks and African slaves who were drawn there during the sugar boom from 1850 to 1950, and Taino Indians. So these are people who are disconnected from our political system. And I went to them and I said, it does not matter that you don't have a congressman, because we have federal laws and nobody is above the law, not even the United States Navy. And I am going to represent you. I'm going to represent you in federal court. And I have here, who I just saw, some members of the Foster Mayor and other members of the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund who were my co-counsel in those cases. And I said, we're going to represent you in front of the courts, and we are going to make the Navy comply with the law. Then I went to court, and I got a judge who sat on that case for 8.5 months, and the Navy kept on bombing. And at one point, and these people were people who were the most humble people, and the most wonderful, really inspiring people, poor and people who really, as I said, they are American citizens, but they do not feel that they enjoy the benefits of living in this country, the political benefits and the legal benefits. And I had promised them that I could get them in front of a courtroom, and I was unable to deliver that. And at that point, I believed that I had exhausted my political and my legal remedies, and that I could offer them nothing except my own civil disobedience. And that's why I made the decision to get in that boat and go up onto the live bomb site. And it's a decision that I never thought twice about, and that has been one of the best things that's ever happened to me, because I met people in that prison who don't have two nickels to rub together, who are whose families are suffering dramatically, who lost their jobs. And those people, it took real courage for them to do this. And they're doing something. A lot of them come from parts of Puerto Rico that are very far from Vieques. Many of them come from Vieques. But they went in and sacrificed and made an authentic sacrifice of themselves because they love that island and because also they love our country and they believe in democracy. Now, I love the United States Navy. I grew up in a Navy family. My father and my uncles were all part of the United States Navy. And I grew up knowing the songs of the Navy, it's still an icon of my childhood, and it's still a service that I love. And I believe also that every nation has the right to ask its citizens to sacrifice their lives for their country during times of war. And my family has risen to answer that call on many occasions. But I do not believe that any nation has the right, or that the United States Navy has the right to sacrifice the lives of children and men and women without their consent for a dubious military exercise during times of peace. And that is not only an offense to Puerto Rico, it's an offense to everybody who considers themselves an American and everybody who loves our flag. And that's why I went and did that civil disobedience. And to me, it's the duty of every one of us to stand up for our country by standing up for the people of Vieques and Puerto Rico. Thank you very much.
I won't back down.
Robert Kennedy, Dennis Rivera, Jackie Jackson, all released from prison after the bombing of Vieques. Their protests. Al Sharpton remains in prison, his sentence 90 days. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland is our technical director. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. And I've been told we should acknowledge those who make Democracy Now! Possible. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting supports Pacifica Radio, and we'd like to thank the Pacifica stations, KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI, as well as the Pacifica affiliates. All of that, of course, means all of you. We are Pacifica. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Banned and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. In a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I stand my ground, and I won't back down.